And that's really our sweet spot, is coming in and helping them hone that fundraising pitch, both verbally and the actual deck itself, because fundraising is an art in itself.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Allison Capon is co-founder of Rad Campaign, founder of Women Who Tech, co-author of a book on social change, and she runs the Women's Startup Challenge in collaboration with Craig Newmark of Craigslist. Allison's received a lot of awards and recognition for her work. You ought to know about her, especially if you're a female entrepreneur. Through Rad Campaign, Allison has helped more than 100 nonprofits, foundations, and philanthropies with their campaigns and websites, and built a resistance tool that ties your contributions to Trump tweets. Through Women Who Tech, she's built a network of over 65,000 entrepreneurs, engineers, investors, and industry leaders, including tons of prominent people. So I wanted to talk to Allison about her various enterprises and activities and entrepreneurship in general and what's going on with technology in the political and nonprofit arenas. It turns out we didn't live far apart, so we had a good talk right at my kitchen table. Now, after a word from our sponsor, my interview with Allison Capon of Rad Campaign.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
So Allison, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Yeah, absolutely. I am Allison Capon. I do a few things. I am the founder of Rad Campaign, which is a social change web agency here in DC, working with nonprofits and associations and foundations, creating open source websites, doing a lot of online strategy, online advocacy, and fundraising. And I also run a nonprofit called Women Who Tech, which we actually incubate inside Rad Campaign. And we are on a mission to really showcase and fund and provide resources to women-led startups.
Two pretty fun things to be doing and giving you a lot of impact in the world.
It's very, very exciting.
Can we sort of trace your career a little bit to how you get to this point? Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to college? What'd you study? That sort of stuff.
I grew up in Miami, Florida, and I went to college at University of Miami. I had a double major in journalism and art history. And then after University of Miami, I worked at a children's museum doing public relations and running a children's film festival, which was awesome. And then I moved to DC to go to grad school, and I went to American University. I majored in multimedia to get my master's, and I was a guinea pig in their program because it was the first year that they had launched it. So it was really cool. I got to really create my own curriculum, and I took classes at the School of Communications, the Business School, the Design School, the Music School. So mine was a combination of web design, internet marketing, and graphic design. And I also threw some sound design into there with the School of Music. It was basically about combining all of these mediums together that were focused on digital. And really, that's kind of culminated in my entire career.
And that's been a huge trend in society,
right?
Generally. So it seems like the time you spent at Tobacco Free Kids put you into an advocacy world and a communications world. Well, tell me about that experience.
So I was with Campaign for Tobacco Free Kids, for about 5 or 7 years. I had started that position really focused on kind of how to leverage the internet for organizing. And I was still in grad school at the time, and part of what I was doing in grad school was focused on social justice issues. So it was an amazing experience for me to really leverage all of the skills that I had been learning in grad school and then be able to apply that in a real world environment and to be able to take on this very powerful tobacco industry that was grossly targeting kids with all of their marketing. It was just so empowering. We got to experiment. I remember we shut down the White House fax machine, which sounds like really funny right now when we talk about it.
I wonder if there is even a fax machine anymore. Probably there is.
But to be able to kind of like overwhelm them so much where like they had to shut down the fax machine was pretty incredible. And the organization, like we did some amazing work just like with all sorts of online organizing and experimenting at the time that is like true tactics that are used still today. So it was a very exciting time just to test and experiment and see what worked and what didn't. That was great.
It seems hard right now to think about who wants kids to be smoking.
Right. The tobacco industry does.
They still do, you think?
Oh, yeah.
They have the cartoons and Camel or whatever. What was the most egregious thing that you remember?
Well, they did a lot of things. I mean, first of all, there were a ton of sponsorships. So they would sponsor major concerts that they knew teens would be going to. And
try to make it cool.
Yeah, try to make it cool. Yeah. And then they also had a lot of candy flavored cigarettes. And I'm sure that you may remember them kind of growing up. I do.
I remember like the white. Pink, it was nothing to do with a cigarette, but it was in the shape of a cigarette in a box like cigarettes.
You would suck on it and it would have fake smoke coming out, right?
I don't remember that, but yeah.
It was just like, it was sugar, basically, that was coming out.
To get you hooked on the...
You hooked on the idea that smoking was cool. So that's like one just like disgusting way of literally like having candy look like cigarettes. When I was working with Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, they also started rolling out really candy flavored cigarettes that would be sold at convenience stores. And a lot of times they were put up front by the counter instead of like locked and like that only for adults. So that was a really big thing that the industry did to entice kids to start smoking at an early age. But a lot has changed within the tobacco industry, like in the US at least. Internationally, it is still a huge problem. They are still a huge lobby and have a lot of political influence, particularly in third world countries that actually need capital. So while we may be doing better here in the US, the tobacco industry is like, you know what? It's okay. We can go internationally and we're going to make a ton of money.
I've noticed just having a daughter in high school and seeing the vaping that's going on and, mm-hmm. and all of the flavored things that you can intake into your body. Is there a campaign for vape-free kids or anything that's analogous now, or should there be?
Well, it's interesting because that really started by startups. And now we are seeing like Philip Morris and some of these big tobacco companies starting to invest in them. So I hope that there are public health organizations that are going to be taking this on because it is huge.
It is. And dangerous and addictive.
Very. Absolutely.
So what's the founding story for RAD Campaign? How did you get that going and why? And what is it?
I started RAD Campaign with Jared Seltzer as the other co-founder probably my sixth or seventh year at Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. I kind of did it on the side. And the reason that we started it, and Jared at the time was at Center for New American Dream, was there was such a rise in online activism and building websites and building online campaigns. And we weren't seeing a lot of firms emerge that really had the expertise and understanding to do it and to do it right. So we were seeing like a lot of corporate PR firms like trying to come into the sector and be like, hey, you know, I think we can cash in here. But they didn't really understand it. So we launched RAD Campaign really as a side hustle to be like, can we do this? Can we work with all of these organizations that we really believe in that wasn't just public health or wasn't just focused on the environment, but reproductive justice and LGBTQ issues, all these issues and that we were passionate about. And we launched it, honestly, and then we never looked back.
What's the founding story for the Women Who Tech?
So the founding story behind Women Who Tech was really my frustration of going to technology conferences. And not that there weren't women in the room, but there weren't women represented on panels or as keynote speakers. And that was extremely frustrating to me because I knew of many incredible women that should be up on that stage. I launched Women Who Tech to really highlight the lack of diversity at these tech conferences. And so we launched something called the Women Who Tech Telesummit. And we brought together these incredible women like Arianna Huffington, Joan Blades, who's the founder of MoveOn, and Rashmi Sinha, who's the co-founder of SlideShare, which was acquired by LinkedIn several years later, to talk about all of these issues, like how to launch a startup, how to get more involved in open source, how to fundraise for your startup. And it was a virtual telesummit, so women from across the world could participate anywhere. And it worked just like a conference, except it was virtual. You could hop back and forth between panels. And it was amazing. It was so inspiring. And these women were from all over the world were like, wow, thank you so much for bringing all these women together, because we never have an opportunity to do that. And we feel so left out of conferences. So we did that for a few years. And then after each conference, we would have networking parties so that the women could network and connect in person. And then after doing it for a few years, we kind of took a step back because at that point, there had been a number of women in tech organizations coming into the space, which was awesome. We want to support everybody. So you had like Women Who Code and Girls Who Code and all of these awesome organizations. And then we took a step back and we said, you know, what isn't being addressed right now? And we quickly saw it was the lack of funding for women-led startups. So about 83% of entrepreneurs either don't get funding or they can't get access to bank loans. So we decided that we were going to do something about it. And that was the catalyst behind launching Women Who Tech.
What sort of impact do you think you've had?
I think we've had awesome impact. So we actually just ran some of our impact numbers. And since we launched in 2015, 84% of the startups have received funding, which is phenomenal.
The people who are attending your program, almost all of them are getting funding.
Yes.
Right, which is exactly. Very rare.
Which is extremely
rare. It's like 2% of right. All venture capital money or something.
That's right. Goes
just to astonishingly low.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's a number that has not moved in many years.
Why is that? I can't quite wrap my head around that, because I do know quite a number of successful female entrepreneurs.
Sure.
And I know that they can do it just as well. Mm-hmm. What explains that enormous disparity right now, do you think?
Yeah. So it's a multi-part problem. So first is the investor community is predominantly white men. And what do? They fund people that look like them, that they connect to, like, hey, you remind me of me, so I'm going to invest in you.
They always talk about pattern recognition.
Right, it's all about pattern recognition, and it's all about networks. I mean, it is in many ways, the investor community is incredibly small. So when they fund startups, they typically look for startups that remind them of themselves. And then what also happens is once these startups are funded, then the startups recommend the investor to their network. And if you're only funding white men, right, and that's their network, then that's who continues to get funding. And if any of these startups like make it really big, then some of the founders become investors. And then who do they invest in? So it's like it keeps going around and around. And it's really challenging to break through.
But it would seem like, and maybe this is already out there, but it would seem like if non-white men are not getting funded, then there's a huge opportunity to fund the really talented people that are being overlooked. That should be drawing rational investors, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there is so much money being left on the table by investors by not funding diverse-led startups. Like, if we are going to really solve the toughest problems facing this world, we can't just do it from this narrow lens, right? We have to do it from this incredibly diverse lens that makes up this entire planet. There have been a lot of studies that have been done to show that women-led startups and diverse-led startups are incredibly capital efficient because, let's face it, they have to be because they are working on such lean resources because they're not getting funding, yet they have a 35% higher return on investment. So there's incredible studies to back it up. It's not about charity or like doing the right thing. There is data behind it that you will make a lot more money by investing in diverse startups. But besides the networking problem, I mean, there's also a lot of sexism, right? There's a lot of sexism and there's a lot of harassment that is happening within the tech community and within the investor community. We did a survey back in 2017, where we surveyed over 700 people that work in tech and that were also founders. And we found out that 44% of women who work in tech and are women founders experienced harassment. I mean, it's insane.
And I would assume it's also that some women who ought to be starting companies aren't, because they don't see the models, because they're worried that they're not going to be treated the right way, that they're not treated equally. So all these things kind of add up. Is there a trend in so many fields, in the legal profession, in the medical profession, in Congress, there is a upward trend for women? Is there an upward trend in entrepreneurship?
Yes, there's definitely an upward trend in entrepreneurship by women and also by people of color. And it's grown exponentially, like over the last decade. But what we're not seeing happen is the funding side, right? So a lot of this has to be self-funded. It has to be friends and family. And that's what we are trying to break through. So we have seen an incredible rise in the number of women-led startups, and we see it every year. We have over 2,300 women-led startups in our pipeline.
What does that mean, in your pipeline?
Meaning that we have 2,300 women-led startups that have applied to our women startup challenges that we have access to. We have their decks. We have all of the information on them that we would love to open up to investors to fund. The reality is, for Women Who Tech, being a nonprofit, we can only work with about 20 startups a year, right? Mm-hmm. And so what happens to all of these other amazing women-led startups that we can't support because, you know, we're the small and
mighty. So they have to kind of win the lottery to get.
They do. Yeah. They do. And so it often feels like the cards are just stacked against them.
I've been following, in this podcast and outside of it, the political startup space. Mm-hmm. For me, that's political technology firms. Yep. That's also resistance organizations and other political startups that are not all for profit. Many of them aren't, but there's a mix of things. Do you follow that space at all?
I do.
And the funding in that? I've noticed that some of the funders really do have a focus on diversity in that space. But what do you see when you're looking mm-hmm. at that subset of our market?
Yeah, it's interesting. And by the way, I'm seeing this with investors as well in the a traditional startup community.
They're changing.
That they're talking about it. Yeah. So talking and acting is very different. We are definitely seeing investors from both sides, from the political side and the kind of the more traditional side, talking about the importance of funding diverse startups. We're not necessarily seeing the numbers. I'm probably seeing a little bit more on the political side,
but
in terms of
disparity
diversity.
Remains.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, think about some of, I'm not gonna, you know, name them now, but it's all right. I don't need to trash anybody.
Well, you could, it doesn't have to be trashing. It can be useful information.
But if you think about some of the bigger startups that have gotten funding in the political space, it's practically run by white men.
The ones with large amounts of money.
Yes. Yeah.
I can't think of any. I'm thinking of Phone to Action. I don't know if you mm-hmm. know them, but they have a female founder and a white male CEO who was, I guess, a co-founder.
Yeah.
But that,
I've only spoken with him. Yeah. So that's interesting.
Is to me the kind of the force behind that in a lot of ways. But it's And I don't know how much they've raised.
They're doing great.
Yeah, they are.
I was asked to talk with someone who is running a fund that is focused on the political space. And they came to me and they're like, hey, we really need help because we don't know how to reach women-led startups. I'm not going to out them. I'm here to support investors that want to make a difference.
Well, while you're on that subject,
you're
kind of known for working with the founder of Craigslist.
Yes, Craig.
Craig Newmark. How did you originally come across him and build a relationship there?
So Craig and I actually began working together through Rad Campaign when he decided that he wanted to focus more of his time on philanthropy. So we worked with him to really identify what his goals were in doing with philanthropy. And we built something together called Craig Connects, which was basically his vision for doing philanthropy for the next 20 years. And now it's evolved into Craig Newmark Philanthropies, like a full-fledged foundation, which we're very, very excited about.
And what do you continue to do with him?
So these days, I'm really focused on working on the Women in Tech initiatives with him. So
that's something he cares about?
Yes, it is. It is one of his key funding areas, and he has been an incredible ally. We could never have launched the Women Startup Challenge without Craig's support. And that's something that I really want to talk about. Like, when we do these programs like the Women Startup Challenge and Women Who Tech, we can't do this without male allies. Like, we're not here to silo this, that it's up to women.
It makes no sense.
To fix this problem, right? Yeah. We're all in this together. And that's why it's so important to us to work with people like Craig, who really believes in this and wants to be able to support this and be a role model of what a male ally looks like in the space.
What advice do you give to aspiring female entrepreneurs?
I'm sure
there's a lot.
There's a lot.
Hit some highlights.
If someone was just trying to break into this and launch a startup, it has incredible highs and it has incredible lows. And you have to be prepared for that. It is such a roller coaster ride. And I know that you know this, like starting your own.
You got to manage your own emotions along the
way. Yeah, it's hard. And you got to build a team and you got to be financially responsible. I mean, like you're like responsible for other people's livelihoods. Mm-hmm. People don't realize like what they're getting into. They just get really excited like, oh, I want to launch this. I have this idea and I just want to launch it. But they don't understand what it actually takes to launch and manage it.
What resources would you direct them to?
What resources? So one of the things that I did before I started Rad Campaign was I actually took a really great class by the Small Business Administration here in DC, and it actually walked you through like how to set up a business plan, and I believe it was free. I don't even think that they charged for it.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, they have like amazing resources.
Have taken that. God knows how well
it would be. And they also will do like follow-up advising with you. I didn't actually take advantage of that, but it was very, very helpful in thinking through how to organize a business plan. So that's definitely an incredible resource. Also, I think it's important to think about if you are not doing a consulting firm, but you are doing a startup, is thinking about the capital that you're going to need.
Like a product type operation.
Right, like a product type operation. Thinking about the capital that you're going to need and really bootstrapping as long as you can. There are a few startups out there, actually Craigslist is one of them, that hasn't taken a dime in investor money.
I never took a dime at,
good for
at
you.
NGP software until,
that's awesome.
You know, until I sold most of my interest in it. Just worked better that way, I thought.
Yeah.
You actually learn the market.
Boots, you do.
And you don't have to deal with all the time and the irritation of other people
trying
to tell you how to run your business.
That's right. So I always say, like, if you don't have to take investor money,
hell
no.
Not to. Yeah.
Don't do it.
Yeah.
Own all of it, right?
Right.
Because,
unless there's some kind of reason that you have to go fast.
Right.
Some kind of land grab of
right.
something, yeah.
And I do feel that we have been in a market where startups feel like they have to take money to grow as fast as possible. There's an incredible amount of pressure on startup founders. And I remember someone saying this to me a few years ago, and they were like, you got to go big or you got to go home. And I was just like, oh, I hate that mentality.
Well, and actually I think it's false, like, except for in very rare instances. And that most of the examples I can think of healthy, successful businesses started small, started experimentally in certain ways, and learned over quite a period of time how to occupy a market. And I think that's what Rad Campaign did.
Yeah, absolutely. But it also wasn't our intention to become a 1,000-person firm. I would have taken a very different route. Like, that was never my intention. And I do think that there is a lot of pressure for startups to become the next Uber,
the next
Facebook, right? Yeah. And I don't think that that's what you always have to do, right? You can be
well,
a
the
kick-ass.
vast majority of businesses are not occupying that kind of ground,
right?
And they still are good businesses.
Absolutely.
And sometimes better businesses.
The pressure is put on them to be that, no matter what industry they're in.
Because a certain type of investor, that's all they want is an outsized return and a big multiple or something.
They want a 10x return.
Yeah. Tell me a little more about this startup challenge. How does it work?
So what we do is we open up applications and then we promote it everywhere to reach as many women founders as possible. And as part of the application process, and you've been on our online jury before, it's extensive questions that ask them for their go-to market strategy, what kind of traction they've had, have they been invested in, what are your marketing plans? So it's a pretty robust application.
What I've noticed, and maybe you've noticed this too, I don't know, is that the quality of entrepreneurship is escalated greatly over the last 20 years.
And
what people bring to it, the knowledge, the resources that they're finding, you know, the lean startup books that have produced so many people who are so capable and have so many interesting ideas.
Yeah, it's amazing. We typically can get, you know, over 300 applications for our startup challenges. It is so hard for us to like pare down to the top 10. And the online jury does a great job in helping us narrow that down. But we always struggle with like, it's not 10 that should be up on that stage pitching their products to investors. It could easily be the top 50 that came in that batch or even beyond that. I mean, you're talking about like people who missed it by a quarter of a quarter of a quarter of a point. And it's heartbreaking because like we want to be able to support them.
And you can't really pick the right top 10.
No.
It's just, it's an impossible thing to do.
We do our best.
There's too many variables, too many unknowns,
yeah.
And it's so much about execution.
Absolutely. So once we go through that process and we have several jury members who are either investors or serial entrepreneurs, and they come in and they evaluate the startups and then we get down to the top 10, then we take those top 10 startups through about an 8-week program where we really are focused on honing their fundraising pitch. And I think that's what sets us apart from, you know, other accelerators and programs. Like, they're working with them on like their actual products and iteration, which is great and really needed. But for our startups, they already have a product and they've already launched. And so they're ready to either raise money for the first time or raise their next round. And that's really our sweet spot, is coming in and helping them hone that fundraising pitch, both verbally and the actual deck itself. Because fundraising is an art in itself, right?
So how are you then different from the Y Combinators and the 500 startups?
Yeah, so theirs are typically in-person programs. Ours is all virtual. So particularly, we find that incredibly helpful that there is no barrier in terms of like, oh, I have to pick up and change my life for 3 months and relocate and deal with all that hassle, expenses. If you have kids, I mean, that's also problematic. So for us, it's all virtual. But we're not really focused on the product side in terms of like working with you on your product and that iteration and the technology side and the marketing side. We're focused really on how do you actually raise money? And that's all we do.
And that's a very valuable thing to be offering.
Oh, it's incredibly
especially
valuable.
Especially if you're—
For women.
which you've already shown how that there's that deficit up there.
Right, exactly.
So you're attacking that.
We're attacking that. And the other thing that we also did in our last program, which we want to continue to do, is we also weaved in how do you tell your data story? So that's something that is huge.
What does that mean? How tell your data story?
So how do you tell your data story in terms of how are you using your startup's data? So like, as we know, in the past few years, data has been completely weaponized, right? In terms of like what's happened on Facebook.
And has value.
And it has value, incredible value, but it's also incredibly sacred. And so a lot of startups have traditionally, like in the past few years, one of their big sells has been like, how do we harvest as much data as possible on people and then basically sell it? We have taken a step back and we're like, whoa, this is not ethical. Look at all the problems that it's caused. Like, it cost us an election in the United States. There is violence happening in other countries because of how people are manipulating data and leveraging AI and bots. It is a scary, scary time right now. We want to be able to work with startups and show them how they can build transparency and accountability into their products from the very beginning, before it is too late, and build that into the DNA of the company. And we're working with Mozilla on that.
So that's really, you're bringing an agenda,
right?
An ethical agenda to what you're doing
as
well. Does that ever push out potential people from your, and are you happy about that?
So we started working on this with Mozilla for our last startup challenge in Europe. And that was a great place to test it because, you know, a whole GDPR compliancy, which is something we don't really have here in the US. But it's something that we want to continue to do even for our US challenges because so much is at stake. It is the only responsible way for companies to build a startup right now is to really have that data transparency and accountability. And I don't think anybody was prepared for what happened in 2016 or what we've seen happen in the world, violence that it has caused in countries. And so now is the time to step back as investors, as a startup community, and also think about all of the harassment that has happened on Twitter over the years. The founders of Twitter, white men, never thought that their platform could ever be used for harassment and also as a weapon of hate. They never anticipated that. And so because they never thought how that could happen.
And partially because going through the world as a privileged person, you're not a victim of that on a daily basis, right?
No, not at all.
So why worry about it?
Right. When it did start happening, you know, they took a free speech position. It's free speech. People could say whatever they want. And now, of course, they have walked that back. But this is what we're talking about in terms of like having that lens, right? Of really finding ways to support diverse founders who have very different perspectives.
After you've picked 10, what happens to those chosen ones? And is Craig involved at all at that stage?
Craig does not typically part of the jury. He leaves that to us. But what we do is after the 10 are selected and they go through the program, then we have a demo day that we typically partner with someone like Google on, who is the co-host of the Next Woman Startup Challenge. And then the startups will come and pitch their startups to some very, very prominent investors. And then at the end of the night, one of the startups will be awarded a $50,000 cash grant from our startup. And a big part of that is also due to Craig.
So it must be fun to do.
Oh, it's a lot of fun. Yeah. It's great.
Are people in my area that this podcast is a focus on, the political people, would it make sense for female founders in that area to go to you? Have you funded political type organizations, or is this sort of more in a different area of the economy? Because typically they would go to, you know, New Media Ventures or one of these Higher Ground Labs, one of these very specific funders.
Right. So when I think about the people that have applied to our startup challenges, and particularly the top 10 that have made it in, they're all focused on, honestly, on solving the toughest issues facing this world. Environmental issues, healthcare issues.
These are all social impact.
So they're all like, exactly. But they were never intended to be. We're not a social impact challenge.
It just works out
that
way.
Just...
Because of how you're
Because women
them.
Are better. No.
Some are, some are not.
I'm just kidding. Maybe, no. It is how it works out that way because we're, you know, Justin, who's the director of Women Who Tech, we're not the ones picking the top 10, right? It's the jury. So it is how it shakes out. And it doesn't mean that they're not focused like on like hardcore tech. They are, but they're looking at it through a different lens. Like what kind of problems that we can solve that haven't been solved? This is the result of that.
Rad Campaign seems to operate in that political advocacy and other world,
yes.
Right?
Yep.
What have you learned through helming that you can share with other people that are aspirational in that area?
I think you have to go through the same process of what I was talking about before, like defining, you know, what is the product that I want to build? How am I going to get there? How is it going to be funded? Can I afford to self-fund it? Coming up with that whole business plan. So it's very similar because you have to go through that same process of setting up a business.
So if someone approaches Rad Campaign, right? Mm-hmm. And they say, I've got this thing I want to do, you know, like Stop Citizens United or one of these
right.
numerous groups. Mm-hmm. How do you help them? What can you provide to them to help them enter the market and succeed in it?
Well, we can do many things. We can provide the strategy to get there. We can build the applications that they're interested in building. If it's like a nonprofit versus a for-profit, and they're focused really more on kind of like your traditional advocacy campaigns and recruitment campaigns and online fundraising, like we can do all that. But if it's a product, obviously we would come in with a different lens.
Do you sometimes build a company's software product? Or do you more build their website and the technology for promoting the company?
It depends. Yeah. It depends on the company's needs. We can do either or, just depending on like kind of where they're coming from and also what they can afford to do at the moment.
How big is Rad Campaign?
So we are 10 people. It's a hybrid of developers, project managers, our designer, and strategist.
Why rad? What's the rad part of that?
Yeah, people always ask me that.
Do they? Is it just because it's a cool word? Like,
yeah,
that's rad, man?
Yeah, well, there's two parts. Rad, radical.
Radical, yeah. So it's a political statement,
political
too.
Statement as well.
Yeah.
Sometimes people ask, what does RAD stand for?
Like could be your initials, right?
Right, exactly. But
no one should ever name their company after their initials. I would tell you that right now.
Good marketing advice.
Yes. What is We Can Resist It?
Yes. So We Can Resist It is an...
We Can Resist.it.
Yeah, We Can Resist It. is a web application that we built a few months after the elections to really...
After 2016.
To really tap into the anger and frustration that people were feeling after Trump got elected and unleashed all of his hate and disdain for all of these social justice issues that we have been fighting for, that so many people have been fighting for. And basically the way that it works is we have turned his toxic tweets into donations for social justice organizations. And so every time he tweets, you as a user can donate 25 cents, a dollar, whatever it is that you want.
So you sign up on this site and you pledge a certain amount and you put your credit card in or something?
Yeah, so I'll run through how it works. So basically, you come on to weekandresist.it and you are prompted with a number of organizations that you would like to donate to every time Trump tweets. So you can select Black Lives Matter, 350.org, whichever organizations you're passionate about. And then you're able to select the donation amount that you want to donate every time he tweets. So it can be 25 cents, it can be a dollar. And then you get to set the maximum, right? Because Trump can tweet like 500 times a day. So you don't want to be charged $500 at the end of the month. So you can decide, hey, I'm going to donate up to $10 a month every time Trump tweets to Black Lives Matter. And then you never have to look at it again. So basically, it's a social media twist on building monthly sustainers for nonprofits.
And how was it done?
Oh, it's done great.
How much have people donated through this application?
Yeah, no. So the application has raised close to $100,000 in micro donations, like literally in 25 cent donations. And we have about 11 nonprofits that are on the platform.
Is it growing over time? Did it level off? I'm mostly asking because yeah. I've seen like different shapes of the curve.
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely leveled off. Yeah. And the reason that it's leveled off is because, you know, we're not really actively promoting it. It's like the nonprofits that they have to be the ones taking ownership of it.
If you were promoting it more, do you think it could be promoted with a return on that investment out to the donor organizations? Or do you think it's not worth putting advertising around it?
No, I think that they should be putting more money into it.
Yeah.
Or rather, not the organizations, that they should be putting more promotion into it.
Oh, I see.
Because
You're counting on them to raise money because
right,
they're getting money.
Because they're getting the money.
Rather than you doing it.
But what we have learned through the experience of kind of rage fundraising is that what the nonprofits really need for this next iteration is for it to be white labeled. Because right now it's part of something called We Can Resist It with like our brand right. and
they
everything
want, they
else.
Don't want that. They want it to be...
Well, they do want that, but then they also want...
To put it on their site
and have their own branding.
Do you intend to change
and
that?
And so that's what we're doing. Uh-huh. So we're about to roll out a white label for the nonprofit that any nonprofit actually could be a part of with their own brand, their own messaging, their own advocacy targets.
What about not tying it just to Trump's tweets?
Well, that's it. Yeah, it's not going to be tied to his tweets.
Okay, good.
It's going to be tied to any legislative target or even corporate accountability target that you as an organization choose to target. And we're also going to be leveraging hashtags. So we think that one of the biggest nuts to crack that the nonprofit space hasn't been able to has been leveraging social media for fundraising. Like in huge moments, you will raise money, like if you're a big enough organization. And if you
are like the ACLU raised a ton of money.
Oh my God,
a ton
totally.
Of money because
yeah.
they were a place that people knew to go
That's
to
right.
to fight the administration.
That's right.
Right.
And they're still raising money, but it's not like they raised a huge amount of money in a short period of time. They're not raising that type of money through social media right now.
Do you take any piece of those contributions to run the site or to
we
manage
do.
The admin?
What, we do. We take 2%, just to kind of make it run and cover some of the cost.
What are some emerging tech trends for nonprofits that you're excited about?
So I'm really interested in thinking through how we leverage more AI and machine learning to really gather data and learn more what drives people to donate. Like, how do they make that first donation? How do you convert them from that first donation to monthly sustainers? And we've been talking about this in the nonprofit space for a long time, but I don't think that we've ever really leveraged AI machine learning to basically classify all of the data that we've been collecting through these different channels. So like through our ECRMs, through social media, and actually through your traditional CRM, like a Raiser's Edge or whatever offline fundraising platform that you're using. So I'm really interested in classifying all of this data and mapping it to determine what is going to drive that first donation. And it's going to be different for different people, right? Based on gender, based on location, based on issue, based on what campaign they came in on, and trying to map all of this. And I don't think that we've gotten there yet. I think we've just skimmed the surface. And so I know Engaging Networks is actually working on a platform like this to integrate with their ECRM. And I think it's going to be a game changer because we're not seeing the ECRMs really take all of this data and put it into one place and start to classify, like, how do these donations truly get triggered? Because it is different for different people. And I think that we have been looking at it from not a holistic perspective, but just from like a massive perspective. Like, every time you sign up to an email list, it gets triggered a welcome series, right? And everybody gets the same welcome series. They get it at the same exact time. But I think it's everybody is actually different, and things are going to motivate people differently based on all of this data and criteria. And so that's what I'm really excited about.
So you're talking about a product that would be an add-on to the CRMs
exactly.
that are out there.
Exactly.
Do you think there will be a welcoming by the CRM vendors of that technology, or will they want to like do their own thing?
Yeah. I think it's a great question. And I actually asked that to the founder of Engaging Networks. I said, you know, as soon as you release this, every other ECRM is going to try and replicate this because it's frankly a great idea. And so I do think that this is where it's going. And I think you're already seeing, you know, startups that have absolutely mastered this type of data accumulation. And so I think it's time for the nonprofit sector to truly catch up. And I do think it's going to, honestly, I think it's going to increase donations for the nonprofit sector. And this can also be applied to advocacy.
I understand that your partner is actually your husband.
Yes.
In your business.
He is.
And I know from being married that might make life a little trickier. How do you manage that?
So we work in separate offices. That is number one. We don't work in the same room,
building,
in the same building, in the same office space, but the way it's basically a converted row house mm-hmm. where we work. So there are, you know, several different spaces. So we work at opposite ends of the spaces.
Mm-hmm. And with a direct arrow shot between them?
No, there's no direct arrow shot. But we also have very different roles in the company. Yeah. So Jared is the CTO and really heads all of the web development. And I had most of our business development and creative strategy.
But wouldn't you, of all people, want to have a female CTO?
Well, I started it with my husband, so I can't really kind of boot him out since we started
it
together.
Kind of problem. What if you find out that he's underperforming, and you're the CEO?
If Jared was underperforming, which he is not, he's an incredible CTO, then like any other staff person, we would have to have a chat and set goals. And performance metrics. But no, seriously, he's a great CTO.
I mean, is he better as CTO or as husband?
That's a crazy question. He is so awesome at both.
Wow, I wish I could get reviews like that. What other emerging tech trends would you like to discuss?
So there are a couple. One that I think is really interesting for us to talk about is peer-to-peer texting and what really came out of the 2016 elections.
I've had several people doing peer-to-peer texting on the show. What does that mean to you, just to summarize for people that may not be up on the technology?
Sure. So peer-to-peer texting is when you get a text from a campaign about a specific issue. It's asking you to sign a petition, asking you to register to vote. The peer-to-peer texting that I am talking about is coming from a stranger. It's on behalf of an organization, and it's being done basically, you as a volunteer are signing up to mass text complete strangers on specific issues or to get out and vote. So this is what I want to talk about. So it was
seems like it's going to create so much
spam
on phones and burn out that channel.
That's right. Yeah. And so,
it's also useful. I know.
Right. So that's
because it's fresh, and so you do get people's attention this way.
Right. So it was kind of the breakout technology in 2016 for the elections, and then we definitely saw it leveraged for 2018. And you have companies that have grown in our political space dramatically,
like Hustle Relay.
Exactly. But here's the thing: most of the time, you're getting text from complete strangers, so it's already beginning to feel like spam. The other issue is that the data isn't clean. So a lot of volunteers actually ended up having negative experiences because they ended up texting people who were on the opposite side of the aisle, and then they ended up getting like cursed out because people were really upset.
So who was giving them the lists that they – because that – Yeah, not going to work typically.
The data is not clean. So there were a lot of complaints about that, and it's not a positive volunteer experience. The other issue that I have with it is that, you know, you've seen all these amazing case studies that, like, it made, you know, such a difference on this campaign or this election, but we actually don't have the hard data on it. And that's something that I'm really concerned about because the companies can't totally track the data. So first of all, part of it is relied on self-reporting, right? Did you go and register to vote? Did you go and actually vote? So that's self-reporting data. The other issue
although
is
they
that,
do sometimes like go back and analyze the voter file for
true. The other issue is that it's not connected to the organization's eCRM. So if it was a petition or it was a donation, the peer-to-peer texting company can't tell what actually converted. They have to rely going back to the nonprofit and being like, hey, can you tell us like what percentage of donations actually came through? And sometimes the nonprofits will share it, but a lot of times they won't.
Aren't they sometimes integrated with the CRMs?
We're actually doing a report right now on nonprofit tech trends. What we're hearing from the companies is that they have not been able to truly track this data.
Okay. Well, it does sound like an important thing to keep your eye on.
It does.
And to be able to advise your clients to do in the right way.
Yes. The other issue that I wanted to talk about, or rather the technology, is chatbots. So this is another big thing that startups are using and that I think is an interesting thing for nonprofits.
So can you start out by defining that? I mean, we had the guy who started ResistBot on the show earlier, and that was a very successful, highly adopted technology. But what exactly is a chatbot?
So a chatbot is something that sits in the background. It can be either through Facebook Messenger, it can be on your website, and it's basically a machine that is having a conversation with you about various issues. It's typically, for the most common user, done in customer support roles, like to help answer frequently asked questions.
It responds to your instant messages with some other instant message.
Right.
And has some intelligence, intelligence, about what to do.
Key. Yeah. Yeah. So it's been interesting because everybody in the startup world thinks that this is like, you know, going to be one of the biggest technologies, and a lot of people are scared that this is going to replace people in jobs. It's interesting for the nonprofit space because if you're a nonprofit that has a program that does rely on customer support, or you have an e-commerce store, I think it can be very interesting to, you know, help field some of those frequently asked questions that the team is constantly barraged with. And so Planned Parenthood has come out with a really cool chatbot called Rue, and it's aimed at 13 to 17-year-olds who...
That's Rue how spelled how?
R-O-O.
Mm-hmm. And like kangaroo, like yes. Rue from... Yeah, Winnie the Pooh. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's aimed at 13 to 17-year-olds who want to be able to ask health questions or embarrassing questions that they don't want to ask other people. And I think it's a great way for a nonprofit to leverage a chatbot like that. But the downside of chatbots is that it's still not a mature technology. And so you can end up creating a frustrating experience for someone who's interacting with that chatbot trying to get information. And I'll tell you an example.
It also seems a little strange for a pregnant mammal, say, to seek help from a marsupial like Rue.
It's a really good point. I'm going to share that feedback with them. I'll let you know what they say. But in all seriousness, I just had an experience myself with a chatbot that threw me into this endless loop where I was asking it a question about some resources that it was providing. And we were having a great chatbot conversation. And as a normal human being would do, I thanked it and said, "Oh, thanks for the resource." And it responded, "I'm sorry, I don't understand your request."
Right.
And I was like, "Oh, what a fail." And this was actually a chatbot company.
Yeah.
Because I was actually testing it for some clients. And I was like, wow,
if
the company can't even get it right.
Have any of the nonprofits tried to do this with Alexa? Because you can install Alexa words or whatever and have it trigger responses or look things up, right?
Yeah. So so two things with Alexa. American Heart Association, I think your Alexa just went on.
Oh, Alexa, what do you think of this interview?
So
I don't have an opinion on that.
So American Heart Association is actually experimenting with the Lex platform. And so what they're doing is they are having Lex bots sitting in the background of their website, social media channels to collect all of this data and experiences of how people are interacting with the American Heart Association. And then the goal is really to take all that data and provide personalized experiences. They're just at the beginning of this. I think it's really exciting. I can't wait to see where it goes. I know that Amazon is very invested in this and is invested in this for the nonprofit sector. And American Heart Association is one of the first organizations that they are really working with to try and hone this.
I'm trying to see if I feel good about this or not, but we'll see how it
develops. Yeah, we'll have to see how it plays out.
Yeah, I feel a little old and cranky about about this way of relating to the world. But when you choose clients for Rad Campaign, mm-hmm. who do you want to work for?
Yep. We do not work with conservative organizations. We only work with organizations that are fighting for, honestly, the issues that we believe in, for social justice issues.
Tell me some of the people that you work with.
And, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. We work with Defenders of Wildlife. And all these organizations are technically 501c3, right?
So they're all nonprofits.
They're all nonprofits.
And you only work with nonprofits?
Primarily with nonprofits. But all of these organizations definitely speak to our values and the positions that we support in terms of protecting wildlife and the environment. So we work with Defenders of Wildlife. We work with Communications Workers of America. We work with Clean Water Action, who does like amazing work across the United States in fighting for clean water. We work with American Heart Association. So we work with a diverse amount of clients in terms of like sectors. We work with National Center for Transgender Equality. So organizations that we support and that we are fighting for to get them funding and to pass legislative battles and all this stuff that honestly we're fighting the administration on.
Like if you were looking back on this long stretch of running Rad Campaign mm-hmm. with a partner,
right?
what would be like the top highlight or two?
I really love the advocacy fights. So like when we get to work on Planned Parenthood campaigns or working with Clean Water Action and taking just a really, really outdated website and being able to envision how this is going to spur activism across the United States, because that's like an organization that, yes, it is national, but then there's also all of these state-based organizations within Clean Water Action. And to me, that's the real power when you get to focus on a state and local, because that to me is building political power.
What makes a bad client for you?
We like to work with people who are organized, but the most important thing that we value is respect and compassion. There are things that have come out in the political campaigns about how these people are treating their staff And it is very concerning. And it is not something new. It's something that has always happened in politics. Like, we've heard the horror stories.
When and you're that in happens, D.C., you can't help but hear, this senator is great to their staff, this one isn't.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly. And that is the same thing with nonprofits. And so I think that you can have, just as you said, an incredible nonprofit, like working on an amazing mission, but you can have really crappy leadership. Honestly, you are really crappy to your team, because well, that transfers down to their morale and then how they deal with vendors.
As someone who has led multiple organizations and started multiple organizations, what do you think are the characteristics of a good leader?
I think the characteristics of a good leader is someone who knows how to listen to their team, knows how to hire people that are better than them, and leaves the ego out of it. Someone who can like think through things and be strategic. Also, someone who empowers their client. I think that there are a lot of firms out there that are looking for all of these different ways to make money off of their clients and like do the big upsell. And we don't really do that. We're here to empower our clients. Like, once we build a website for you or build a strategy, like, we want to teach you like how to take it and run, which is a different philosophy than some of the other firms in the spaces. You know, and we also hate shiny object syndrome.
Which is like, I want to do the new latest thing. It can help me with that. And I don't really know why.
Right. Because my boss told me that, you know, X campaign did it. And, you know, we used to hear this like with the Obama campaign, like, why can't we be like the Obama campaign? And I'm like, I don't know. Are you running for president of the United States?
And are you highly charismatic?
Right. So, or like, you know, the ice bucket challenge, like, how do we replicate the ice bucket challenge? We're like, well, you can't. And there are some firms that are probably be like, sure, we'll take your money and we'll help you replicate that. Like, that's lying. You're not going to be able to do that. Come on.
Well, Allison, it's an honor to talk to you today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Allison Capon of Rad Campaign. She's at radcampaign.com. I'm glad Allison and her team are out there helping move us in a progressive direction. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with a Great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.